Welcome to podcast number 69 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is October 1st, 2019, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Paul Comprecos. Paul's fiction writing career owes its start to bad navigation of an 18th century pirate, for it was in 1717 that a ship named Wyda went aground off Cape Cod, reportedly carrying a fabulous treasure. Samuel Bellamy, the ship's captain, was drowned along with most of the crew. In the 1980s, three salvage groups went head-to-head competing to find the wreck. Paul was working for a newspaper covering the treasure hunt. The controversy over the salvage got hot at times, and he thought there might be a book based on the story. He developed his own detective, an ex-cop, diver, fisherman, a PI named Aristotle Sock Socrates. He was more philosophical than hard-boiled. His first appearance was in Cool Blue Tomb, which won the Seamus Award for Best Paperback Novel. After many years in the newspaper business, Paul turned to writing fiction and churned out five more books in the series. Clive Cussler blurbed, "There can be no better mystery writer in America than Paul Comprecos." Several months after the release of Bluefin Blues, Clive called and said a spinoff from the Dirk Pitt series was in the works. It would be called The Pneumophiles, and he wondered if Paul would be interested in tackling the job. Paul took on the writing of Serpent, which brought into being Kurt Austin and the Pneuma Special Assignments team. Austin had some carryover from Sock, and another team member, Paul Trout, had been born in Cape Cod. The book made the New York Times bestseller list, as did every one of the seven pneumophiles that followed, including Polar Shift, which bumped the Da Vinci Code from first place. After eight pneumophiles books, he went back into writing solo. He wrote an adventure book entitled The Emerald Scepter, which introduced a new hero, Matinicus Matt Hawkins. In 2013, he brought back Sock again, in the seventh Socrates book entitled Grey Lady. After that book, he wrote a sequel to the first Matt Hawkins book titled The Minoan Cipher, which was nominated for a Thriller Award in the Best Paperback category for 2017 by the International Thriller Writers. The eighth Sock book, Sharkbait, incorporates the aforementioned story of Wyda, its doomed captain, Samuel Bellamy, and his lover, Mary Hallett. Paul lives with his wife, Christy, on Cape Cod, where she works as a financial advisor. They share a circa 1865 farmhouse with two cats. They have three children and seven grandchildren. To learn more about Paul Comprecos, check out his website at www.paulkemprecos.com. It is my pleasure to introduce Paul Comprecos. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice to those just starting out or to those who are struggling. You will learn from the best. Of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share their favorite detective story. On alternating weeks, we will hear from crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks very much for inviting me.
So, how's the weather up there on the Cape?
Actually, it's quite beautiful. It's a very clear day. I haven't seen much of it. I've been inside trying to deal with the writing stuff, but it's kind of a cool, crisp Cape Cod day. It's just beautiful.
I know, and writing on computers makes it hard to write outside. I think our forefathers who wrote on typewriters could sit at a picnic table and with their Underwoods or their Olympias and just type to their heart's content, or even the predecessors to them could sit with a notebook and pen out what their thoughts were. And us, we have to be careful about our machines heating up out in the sun or the glare on the screen. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, well, I'm one of those forefathers who started off on a manual typewriter. I still have an ancient Underwood that's very, very old, and it makes a wonderful clacking sound. But
and I, too, learned on a typewriter my senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the make of it, but it was in a Catholic school, and it was well-worn, and it was very forgiving for me. So that was nice. As we record this today, it's September 20th. Mm-hmm. We're still at the tail end of a nice summer. And hopefully we'll be airing this episode sometime in the fall. So
great.
Paul, you got to tell me, though, you were a working journalist and decided to get into fiction. So how did that all come to be?
I worked for newspapers for about 25 years. Two different newspapers, primarily on Cape Cod. My most recent stint was for a newspaper called the Cape Codder. It was a weekly newspaper at the time. And I served in a variety of functions, from reporter right up to managing editor toward the end. And it's one of those twists of fate. We had a case on the Outer Cape back in the 80s, I believe, where there were three salvage groups trying to find the and claim the treasure pirate ship, the Witta, which sank off of the Outer Beach, as we call it. And the reporter who was covering that story left to take another job, and I was managing editor at the time, but I also like to write. So I thought it would be an interesting story to cover. So I covered it. There were three groups involved. As I said, they were all very colorful. I remember a guy on one group had a patch over, a black patch over his right eye, and a guy in another group had a patch over his left eye. So they're definitely in the pirate mode. There was a lot of controversy over whether the wreck was out there at all. There was a lot of controversy having to do with the State Archaeological Board, which governed finding and salvaging these boats. And there was a lot of acrimony and competition between the three groups. And as a newspaper man, you look for conflict, but also as a writer, I thought there were the makings of a nonfiction book there. I tried to put something together. I got a few nibbles, but nothing. So if I'd known then what I know now, I would not have decided to write a detective book.
Really?
I hardly read any fiction. I hardly read in any mysteries. I read a lot of nonfiction. I thought I had read what fiction I had read. I looked at it. I said, this can't be that hard. And so I thought I would give it a try. And I came up with my fictional detective, Aristotle, Plato Socarides. And I put him in a position where he was dealing with two salvage groups, two fictional salvage groups over a fictional treasure wreck. So that kind of started me off.
Well, and what you said earlier was kind of surprising, and that's why I said with my surprise in my voice, really, in that you were bringing a fresh approach to writing fiction. There was no pretense, there was no formulas, there was no tropes. You were bringing something from your world into this world, and maybe, just maybe, that's what made it so wonderful. Did you ever stop to think about that?
No, I'd written a few Christmas stories. I wrote a fishing column for the paper, which gave me a pretty good background on fishing, which I was able to use later on the books. So I wrote a couple of kids stories for on Christmas for the paper. So I just started to write. Well, I was lucky enough to have a friend who was also a writer, and she led me to an agency in New York, Jane Rott Rosen Agency, and an agent named Meg Rooley. And we talked about the concept, and she said, do some sample chapters. And I fumbled my way through, and they thought there was something there that was fresh. I hadn't read a lot of mystery detective fiction, but I had read Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And I liked Chandler because of the sense of humor he brought to the Philip Marlowe character. They're very funny books if you read them, even with all the skullduggery and the murders and so on. And they're very humorous books. And so I liked Hammett and Sam Spade. And I also liked the language that Chandler used. It was a very American type of English. Even though Chandler had an English background, he just caught the idiom and the feel of Southern California back in the day. So I thought I would do something like that. And since I'm Greek American on my father's side, I thought, why not have a Greek American detective? There hadn't been one since Kojak. and also Dick Charles and the Thin Man, if a lot of people don't realize, his real name was Charibides, and he was not the Thin Man, of course. Mm-hmm. And so he was of Greek extraction, and I thought that was great. I thought Cape Cod would be a good place to set a mystery. It's got lonely beaches, and it's got marshes and dunes. And when I started writing the books back in the 1980s, it was a place that was very much in transition. There was a lot of development, a lot of new people coming onto the Cape. You know, the Kennedy family was still prominent mm-hmm. in the news. And there was conflict over some of this stuff. And as I mentioned earlier, you look for conflict as a newspaper man. And in a mystery or crime fiction, you look for conflict because it gives people a reason to do bad things to each other. And usually in detective fiction, it usually starts with a murder. So getting back to the Greek thing, I thought, why not a Greek detective? I wanted to make him a little bit different from the hard-boiled guys that I admired. I just wanted something different. And so I gave him kind of a crazy family that drives him even crazier. And I tried to make him slightly more soft-boiled. He's very philosophic. He's kind of messed up because he got messed up in Vietnam. And then he was a Boston police officer. And the backstory is that he was going to marry a nice young woman, and she was killed in a car accident. So that kind of embittered him and brought him to Cape Cod, where he becomes a fisherman. So that in a very large nutshell, is how I got started with the character.
No, and probably some latent PTSD from Vietnam and coming back to a country that didn't appreciate his sacrifice for his country, and you know, we're spitting at him, calling him a pig and a baby killer. So that was interesting that you kind of gave him that backstory, and then the fact that, you know, at the time you kind of veered from the formula of the Mickey Spillanes or the other ones, and of course our earlier pulp fictions that had the guys, you know, always knocking back whiskey and mm-hmm. slapping somebody around with the butt end of a 45. So yeah, so tell me more about Stock, and tell me about his character arc through the novels, and then bring me up to the present if you don't mind.
Well, he had his booze problem, and he was trying to work through that, and so he had relationship problems with women. The relationships didn't last very long because of his mood swings. These were particularly at the beginning of the series. I kind of envisioned, as a writer, sometimes you envision an actor, and I kind of envisioned him as a John Cassavetes. Cassavetes had that, he was Greek extraction, of course, and he had that nervous, very intensity.
Sure.
That you see in some of the movies, like the Tempest, like I was thinking of, where he's an architect and has a nervous breakdown, and I thought that's what he would be at one point he would be have a soft side, but he would still be edgy. He didn't want to take any crap from anyone. He didn't like, after being in the war, which was the epitome of stupidity, he didn't like stupid things. He just tried to do the right thing. And the thing that sold it to the publisher was a family.
Nice.
It was a family angle. I just did a gag thing once. There was a page and a half or something about a private detective who has a Greek family who's in the frozen pizza business. It was like a Saturday Night Live sketch, and I threw it in a drawer. And then when I was working with the agent later on, I was really learning, very naive. And I said, do you think I could be funny in this? And she said, yeah, go ahead. So I dragged that thing out of the drawer, and I worked it into the first few chapters, and they liked it. And they particularly liked the angle of the mother. They had this frozen food empire, and she still kind of runs things in the bakery. And she is described as she's kind of loving, but she's overbearing, and she tries to run Sock's life. And she could spend she's always dressed in black, because back in Crete there are always relatives dying. So she's in a perpetual state of mourning. But she could spend the whole day in a bakery without getting a speck of flour on her black dress.
Amazing.
And that was one of the editors said, that's what sold the series to us. And I sold on the basis of an outline and some sample chapters. I got a 2-book contract with Bantam Doubleday Dell. It's a big surprise to me.
No, that's okay. And I was only adding that you look at the success of a movie and a sequel, My Big Fat Greek Wedding. You know?
Yeah.
So you brought that kind of humor into a soft-boiled detective novel. And, your edgy John Cassavetes, that's a great sight picture, for your protagonist. So realistically, you had a couple real good things going there, and then probably, hopefully, other supporting characters and some nice plotting.
Well, the first book was called Cool Blue Tomb, and then the second book was called Neptune's Eye, which was set up in Woods Hole, which is home of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. There's a lot of research and high-tech underwater stuff that goes on up there.
Sure.
And I thought it would be again, I was looking for contrast between the old Cape Cod fishing business and Woods Hole Oceanographic. And again, it has wonderful fogs that roll in at the end of the day. So I thought it would be a cool place, but I was still working on the characterization. And I was still working for the newspaper, and things weren't. One of the reasons I got into writing was I could see that the things weren't going well at the newspaper, that there's some political stuff going on, and my future was probably limited. As it turned out, it came sooner than I thought, and I had time to write. I had no excuses, and I actually had to sit down and write a fiction book, which was a very daunting task for not having done it before. So my agent was pushing me to get a manuscript off to the editor, and the editor at the time was Kate Mesiak, who edits the Jack Reacher series now.
Really?
And, yeah, she's an amazing line editor. I can still hear her voice in my head now when I mess up. But anyhow, I got a manuscript done, and I sent it off to Kate, and I got a note back saying that she had read the book on a flight to L.A. and that she had some problems, and the problems had to do with plot, setting, and character. And I used to get my mail at the post office. I took that letter, and I went out. I sat in my car in the parking lot, and I said, oh, my God, what am I doing? I should have stuck to journalism. I don't know what I'm doing. And I called her up finally, and she was terrific. And she said, you know, she said, be yourself. Don't be your own voice, because the editors look for a distinct voice in a writer. And they felt that the Sock books had it was very distinct. She said, don't try to be Magnum PI, which was very popular at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good advice. And we worked another 6 months on that book. I submitted a manuscript that came out of Kubu Tomb, and much to my surprise, and that year it won the Seamus Award for Best Original Paperback PI Novel.
That's fantastic. And not to forget, but you're also nominated for the Best Original Private Eye Paperback again, with Sharkbait.
So that
kind of brings you full circle with the Seamus.
That would be nice. I'd be very honored. But anyhow, get back to the history. I did six books in the Socarides series, and I thought they're all pretty good books. But I just didn't make any money on them. It sounds like such a familiar story for in publishing, and they were hard to write. So I thought I would. I was at the point where I was going to quit writing. I was going to find something else to do, make an honest living, as Mark Twain would say. And I got a call from Clive Cussler, and he had read some of my early books, and he really liked it, particularly the underwater aspect. The Sock is always going underwater and getting into trouble. And he asked me to write a spinoff of his successful Dirk Pitt series. It was going to be called The Pneumophiles, and it would have a character named Kurt Austin. And so he kind of saved me right there and brought me back into the writing. I did 8 books with him. They were I was his first co-writer and collaborator, fiction collaborator. They were all New York Times bestsellers. And Polar Shift, which was the middle book, I think, was New York Times number one. It beat out Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. So I have that little arrow in my quiver. But when I was trying to get a handle on the character of Kurt Austin, I called him up and I said I was having problems with that. And he said, well, he said, think Sock. And he said, think of your detective. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said that the series was sold on the basis of Sock, my Sock books. And I said, gee, that's news to me. So I tried to, I was able to use that. And I said, when I looked at it, I said, oh, God, my God, there are similarities. Sock lives in a boathouse on Cape Cod. Kurt Austin lives in a boathouse on the Potomac River. Salk is studied philosophy in college, and Kurt Austin has a library of philosophic books, and he uses philosophy to kind of give him a moral compass in a crazy world. So he had already stolen my ideas, and so I did. Although Kurt Austin is a lot different, more of an adventure figure, I did use some of the same qualities, you know, like a little bit of edginess and a little bit of softness at the same time.
Mm. Now, was Kurt Austin your creation, or was it already fleshed out by Clive?
Well, it was a true collaboration.
Okay.
He sent me, there were four core team characters, and he sent me blurbs on their backgrounds, and I fleshed them out. I had to flesh them out. So I gave them the voice and, you know, then all that. But like I worked, even though I wrote the books, I worked quite closely with Clive. He was just great on, in terms of plot and crazy twists and on character as well. But he's got an amazing mind for a storyline.
And I can tell you, you know, that just earlier when you were speaking, that you put yourself in Clive Cussler and Dan Brown's turf. That was kind of neat how Paul gets in there too with, you know, those two icons of mystery and mm-hmm. And crime. I can tell you that if I'm ever in an airport and don't have a good book, and I know that I've got a 4 or 5 hour ride, there's a Clive Cussler book in the Hudson News that I can pick up, and I will read that. And there have been times when I've been sitting in my driveway after I've driven home from the airport, just to get those last 5 or 6 pages.
He's amazing. He's still going strong at 86 or 87. I think he's got 5 writers writing for him now, including a son.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And Jack DeBruhl, who broke off for a while because of personal stuff, is back in the fold, and he's coming out with a book called The Titanic Secret. And I think it's going to be a big book. Jack's a fine writer, and the premise is really good. But anyhow, after I did the books with Cussler, I wasn't sure what to do, and I talked to Clive, and I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, well, why don't you write the sock book? And he talked to his agent, Peter Lampack, and I said, I don't know what to do, Peter. And he said, well, why don't you do an adventure book? You know how to do them. So I ended up doing both. I did a book called Emerald Scepter, and I created a new character, Matt Hawkins, who's a ex-SEAL underwater robotics engineer. And I did that, and it was a very Cussler-esque book. I went through Suspense Publishing. And then after that, I wasn't sure what to do, but I had some people ask me about the sock books, and are you ever going to do another one? In fact, I was on a podcast, and someone asked me that question. And I talked to my wife after that, and she said, yeah. I said, maybe I should do one. And she said, well, why don't you do it? So I did a book called Gray Lady, which was reintroducing Salk after 15 years, except primarily on Nantucket.
And is he 15 years older now?
No.
At that point? No.
A couple of people advised me. They said, why don't you just make it 10 years in the future? Because it's amazing how much has changed, particularly in technology, in over 10 years or 15 years. You know, when I first started doing it, the internet wasn't used as extensively. You didn't have cell phones weren't as prevalent as they are now. Amazon was a gleam in Bezos' eye probably back then. So I wanted to use some of the advances that have been made so it wouldn't be too antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent it 10 years, and even though he doesn't use a cell phone, which he hates, I did introduce cell phones in and stuff like that. So it's a good book, I think. And then I did a sequel to The Emerald Scepter, I called it, Mayan Cipher. And then I did, after that, I did another sock book, my ace sock book, which came out last year, and it's called Sharkbait.
Okay. That's right. Hmm. And that's what became the nominated Seamus Award Best Original Private Eye paperback. So
yeah,
congratulations again for another award nomination. And are you thinking of making it out to Dallas for the conference?
Before I answer that, my book, The Minoan Cipher, also was a nominee for Best Paperback for a Thriller Award 2 years earlier, 2 years ago, in the Best Paperback category. So they announced the winners at the Thriller Fest banquet in New York. So I didn't win, but I was nominated by the International Thriller Writers, which is a wonderful organization.
Sure is.
And then I got another nomination now by another great organization, Private Eye Writers of America. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how to get to Dallas. We're going out to CustrCon in October, which is the fan conference for the Clive Cussler Collector Society. This year it's being held in Phoenix, out near where Clive lives and has we're doing that in October, and we're trying to figure out how to get to Dallas on the way home.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's very hard to get to Dallas from Phoenix. You have to go through L.A. and through. I'd love to get there for the banquet, but at this point, I'm not sure.
I don't know what airline uses Dallas for a hub. I think maybe
Southwest does, but
okay.
Yeah, but it's really difficult. We're still, my wife's very good about that, so we're still working on it. I would love to be able to stop. You know, win or lose, it would just be great to be at the banquet and see everyone.
So I've got a couple questions before we move into the next segment, and this was one that kind of hit me as I was just sitting here. Did you ever dive, or do you dive?
Well, when I started the Socarides book, I made him a diver.
Right.
He was a part-time fisherman. He was a part-time private detective. But he also had gotten into diving in Vietnam, and he continued doing commercial jobs, as the story goes. And he uses these diving skills in the stories. And they were always an integral part of, he'd be diving on a wreck, or he'd be diving on something or other and get into trouble. So I knew diving from, you know, watching TV and the Lloyd Bridges program and reading about it. But I went out and got my dive certification so that I would know the equipment and the nomenclature, and so that I would know what it felt like to be underwater, to get into a wetsuit and get into cold water and how it feels when you're at pressure, and all these little tricks of so that I was able to incorporate those into my writing. I didn't do a lot of diving. New England, where I live, the water is very cold and it's quite murky. I did a little saltwater diving, a little freshwater diving. I think the last dive I did was in the Virgin Islands. My wife and I dove on there's a wreck called a Rhone, which is a wonderful wreck to dive in. It's in very clear water off of St. Croix. And it starts off at about 20 feet depth and goes down to 85 feet. So you can go down your comfort level, and you don't have to wear a clunky wetsuit. You can just go down in a bathing suit or one of those things. Yeah,
and tanks or a breather.
With tanks.
Okay. Now the other question I had was about the salvors making their attempt to find the Wida. Did they ever find it?
A guy named Barry Clifford was his group was the one who actually found. It wasn't the wreck itself. I'm not even sure if that the wood would still stand up. He did find a dump site, so he found a lot of really interesting stuff, weapons, clothing. He found a lot of coins, gold coins. This was that pirate, Samuel Bellamy, was a very successful pirate, and when his ship was caught in a storm. So he did find a pile of stuff and is still finding things, and they ended up establishing a museum on Cape Cod in the town of Yarmouth, which is quite good, and it has a lot of those artifacts. Very good presentation. The thing is, I found on doing research was that even if you find coins, then it becomes a question of what you do with them. Like Mel Fisher and the Atosha in Florida had a bunch of coins. But he sold them individually. But once you have them out there, you flood the market, and it's not right to melt them down for the gold. So what those guys did with the Wida, which is very smart, is they put them in a museum. People come in and look at them. They pay for the tickets, so it's an ongoing source of income.
Cute. That was neat. So you mentioned reading the classics, and you know, to people outside of crime and crime fiction and police procedurals, the classics might be Shakespeare and Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald. But you named two out of the three icons in our business, which is Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and then of course Ross McDonald. But who did you find to be a fictional character that you found that you enjoyed, and what was the author or originator of that character yourself? I mean, what's your reading go in that direction?
Well, I suppose in talking about the classics is that I love Joseph Conrad. I have his books, Lord Jim and Heart of Darkness, and his Sense of the Sea. He captures the sense of the sea. It's just amazing. Things stick in my mind about the wide, someone being on a ship and looking off at the wide disc of the sea, and that just seemed to describe it so perfectly when you're out at sea. And I liked, from non-mystery, I like Graham Greene because of the moral dilemma that the characters are placed in. That kind of appealed to me, that people have to make a choice. People who are not prepared to make a choice about something that's really life and death threatening, and to make the right choice quite often in his books, even though. So I like those as the classics. I like Chandler, as I said, the detectives, some of the newer guys, not so new, Don Westlake. He wrote a very funny series called the Dortmunder series about it's kind of like a gang of couldn't shoot straight. With Dortmunder was a retired burglar who would pull together this gang on Cape or another, and it would invariably go bad. And just a wonderful bunch of characters. And from present day guys, I like Michael Connelly. I think the Bosch character really, it's kind of like, he's moody. He's always trying to do the right thing. He goes outside regular channels. I meant to mention earlier that people have asked me, what about, were you influenced by any TV programs? And I say, oh, yeah. And they said, what, the Rockwood Files? And I said, maybe a little bit, the fact that Rockwood lives by the sea, like my character. But I always like Harry O, that David Jansen played.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, he lived in a beach house in San Diego, and he just was seen like a conflicted character, which is what Sock is, trying to do the right thing and being pulled in all sorts of directions. And if you go to basic narrative form, which is as old as the hills, it still hasn't changed. It's the character trying to get someplace, trying to accomplish a goal and having to overcome obstacles. And sometimes the obstacles are external, like the bad guy shooting at him, and sometimes they're internal, which can be even more debilitating, like the ghosts of the past or indecision or hubris and all those things, that human qualities.
Well, Paul, do you have a go-to author that you like for their fictional detective? I know you just mentioned Connolly and Bosch.
I think he's the one I like the most right now.
Okay. And, you know, I find that the character arc of Harry Bosch, who also a tunnel rat in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So he's getting up there in age. And with some real issues, the unsolved death of his mother.
Yeah. Yes.
And how he was brought into this world with what her background was, and I think no father. Oh yes, we know who his father is. But no father in his. Oh yes, I guess his father was in his life. Interesting twist by Connolly. I'm not going to give it away. And then also getting married and what happened with his wife, and then how he has a child. And now he has he's sort of partnered up with a young female detective who has her own history, Renee Ballard. So, you know, kind of cute how, you know, Connolly has brought that all around. And,
When I went to do my second book, and this is where a good editor like Kate Mesiak comes in, I wrote something, sent it off to her, and she said, I think you should bring something in out of Sock's Vietnam past. And I thought, gee, what could I do that? What could do that? And I thought, well, how about a person? And so I came up with a character called John Flagg, and he's a Wampanoag Indian from Martha's Vineyard. And they knew each other in Vietnam. They had become friends, and they had this falling out. There were some moral issues that didn't strike Sock as right, that he thought Flagg was engaged in, and violence, like, you know, killing people. So they meet up again in Neptune's Eye. They meet up, and they end up reluctantly having to work together on the case. And it was just, I've included Flagg, who is now a CIA spook, and I've included him in every book, every Sock book since then. He comes on. And there's a wonderful dynamic that's fun to write. He brings in a whole different perspective. He's a little bit of more of a killer character than Sock. In the original one, he brought in his own baggage, growing up as a Native American, having to deal with discrimination. And although his job bothers him sometimes, he goes out. And it also builds in more of a world perspective, so that, you know, these books are basically regional detective books, but by bringing in John Flagg, I can introduce international themes. For instance, in Track Bait, there's a subplot that has to do with Croatia and Kosovo and the massacres and international war criminals and stuff like that. So you can relate that to little old Cape Cod. And Shark Bait, incidentally, also uses a come full circle, it seems. I've also used the theme as a plot having to do with the widow and the story of the pirate, Samuel Bellamy.
Okay. And just looking at it now on Amazon as we're talking, lovely cover. Your publicist or your publisher knows how to put together a book that, you know, will sell. You can tell a book by its cover, and in this case, you know, they do a pretty damn good job. So, and it also says number one New York Times best-selling author. So, I mean,
yeah, you got a plug. Oh, my wife just a little while ago showed me. We've had a real great white shark problem down here, which is kind of the genesis of the idea behind the book. There are lots of white sharks on the outer shore, and she just showed me a picture of a taken recently of a guy on a surfboard, and there's a fin going right by it. It's a boogie board.
Oh boy!
And this is, you know, how crazy this is, because just last year at this time, we had a boogie boarder killed by a shark. It was one of the first shark fatalities in years, which was in the book there. In the town of Wellfleet, someone although it's questionable, is killed by a great white shark. And 5 months later, someone in the same town was actually killed by a great white shark. So they're out there. It's a very topic of conversation here, but people seem to have gotten used to it around in these parts.
Not as sensationalized as it had been during the Peter Benchley, Steven Spielberg crazed Jaws days.
It's just completely different. Until the guy was this young man was killed. It's really, the sharks have really been good for business. That's crazy.
I know. So, Paul, what are you doing these days? What's happening? I know you're going to be traveling for Phoenix and maybe possibly Dallas, but any new books on the horizon? Anything that is going to be coming out soon?
Yeah, I decided to try something a little different. And I've been working for the last year, off and on a standalone. In other words, it's not a series book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sock book. And I decided to have a female protagonist for a change. And she's the basic elevator speech story is that she's an art historian who stumbles on a World War II, finds a clue to a World War II secret in a sketch by the artist Edward Hopper. And the backstory, the historical backstory, is set on Cape Cod and on Nantucket and in Boston. And the historical backstory is that back in the late 1920s, a bunch of German glider pilots were invited to Cape Cod to try and break the Wright Brothers record, which they did. And there was even a glider school set up here for a while. And there were a bunch of Germans around here. And I thought it failed after a year because it was successful for a year, but school went under in 1929 with a crash. And I thought, what would happen? What happened to all those German guys who were there? Did anyone ever come back to Cape Cod? And if they did, why? And that kind of started me thinking and integrated. So I'm closing in on that.
Do you have a name for it yet?
No, I've got about 40 different titles, but I can't pin down one. It started off as Nightwing. Oh yeah, there's a little bit of high tech stuff, kind of holdover from my Cussler days. I couldn't resist putting in some some crazy high tech stuff in toward the end, which I think is fun stuff. And I tried Nightwing. I tried what? You'd be surprised how many titles, when you go to come up with a title, how many have already been taken. I tried one that goes The Man with the Silver Eyes, and I looked that up. It had already been taken. I'm not sure. I want to get to the book has so many themes going through it. I want to go through it again and try to determine what theme I want to emphasize.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And the nice thing about this, after how many books, you're still having fun?
I tell people, and they say, oh, you love it. You don't want to retire. You love it. I say, well, I don't always love it. I love it when it's going well. It's going well, it's fun. When it's not going well, when you're trying to figure out what comes next and trying to find that voice that really or would make a book or break a book, it's not fun. So I have fun sometimes, and sometimes I don't. I threaten to quit, retire. About once a month, I threaten to retire. But at the time when I was working with Kussler, this was, oh my gosh, this was when did I start with him? 1998. I was with him for about 10 or 11 years. And we'd get a book done, and he'd say, this is my last book. And I talked to his agent, and I just talked to Clive, and he says he's not going to write anymore. And he said, I know this animal, but you just wait. And sure enough, Clive would come up with an idea for another book. And now he's putting out more books than ever. It's unbelievable. The guy is so talented. It was an honor to work with him.
Well, this is a good time to break, I think. How can people get in touch with you, Paul? I mean, if they want to know more about Sock and your other books.
I have a website.
Okay.
I think it's paulcapricos.com, and there is a way if it does tell about the background and history and so on. And it's got some wonderful pictures of me. And they can go through there. People can contact me, and I always respond when I get letters. I don't get a lot of them, like Patterson maybe or Custer.
Yeah.
I always respond.
And since it's a different voice, I'll say it what it is. www.paulkemp, as in Paul, REC as in Charlie, OS.com. And because I know when we all say our own names, we know how to say them, and we say them so often, but for other people listening, sometimes they don't hear it quite right. But that's the website, and if they want to get in touch with you, they certainly can. Well, this was wonderful. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. I enjoyed knowing about how it all got started and how you were able to take a pivot with the Kussler books, how you were able to bring Sock back. And then now on your latest one, which really sounds neat. I mean, I got to tell you, just from hearing it already, I think the pre-orders are going to be really solid for that, because you're combining a little bit of Sock, a little bit of Clive, a little bit of everything that you've done, but you're bringing a fresh perspective and hopefully a great premise. I mean, a World War II secret, glider pilots on Cape Cod, a art piece with a clue in it, a little Dan Brown going on there. So it all sounds really good, and I can't wait for that to come out. And when it does, you'll let me know, right?
I may even have a title by then.
Well, you know, that's fine. You know, I don't know. I don't know how titles work.
I don't either. But to answer your earlier question, the research has been a lot of fun. Like last week, we drove down to the beach, and Edward Hopper had a studio overlooking the beach on Cape Cod Bay. So we walked out to the beach, and I made some notes, and I was able, I'm using that in the description as part of the plot. So that kind of research is almost always fun. It's just putting it down on paper or in the computer that's a little tricky sometimes.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. You get to go to Cape Cod, to the place where a noted painter painted his sketches and did his thinking. For my next book, I get to go to Detroit.
Detroit. What's the book?
I'm not going to give away the storyline.
I don't want to. Go ahead.
No, but the title is called Detroit Wheels. And believe it or not, it hasn't been taken yet. And even if somebody did take it, I'm still going to name it Detroit Wheels. And it's the second book in my Marsha O'Shea trilogy.
Cool.
And it's going to have some very interesting things going on. I've been to Detroit Airport where I've had to stare out the windows while my plane was canceled and I had to sit there for 5 or 6 hours.
But I never
stepped off outside. I've never been to Tiger Stadium. I've never been to where the Lions play. I've never been to anything downtown, the Ford Museum, anything like that. So it's nice that and Southwest does fly there. So
yeah,
and so will my bags. They'll fly free. And I will go to Detroit and probably use Priceline to get me a cheap hotel and a cheap car rental. But it's all tax deductible, as you know. It's research for your novels. So
yes, absolutely.
But I get
even it should be fascinating because that's such an area that's been in transition through boom, through bad, and trying to come back.
So you get to go to Cape Cod. I get to go to Greater Detroit. So,
I grew up in a town in Massachusetts. It was an old shoe factory town called Brockton, and
sure,
it went through in a miniaturized scale, same struggles as Detroit. Matter of fact, there was a movie film though out there in Brockton last year. It was they used Brockton as a location for Detroit. And like during the riots, and so some of the locals who, you know, would been hoping that the city would reputation would come back weren't happy about that. But
no. When they talk about Massachusetts, they attribute certain body parts to Brockton, and we won't go any further than that. So anyhow.
Oh, good. You've heard of Brockton.
Yeah.
It's mostly famous for Rocky Marciano and the professional boxers. So it's coming back, though.
It's a tough town.
It's a tough town.
Paul.
Thank you so much.
I love having you on. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Alan Goodman. After a successful career in the culinary arts, Alan began his private investigations career working for Joe Thornton in Maine. He then bought the business from Joe, Lawyers Investigating Services Incorporated. Alan provides a wide range of investigative services to attorneys, businesses, and individual clients. He is a member of his state and several national private investigator associations. He is the former national director of the National Association of Legal Investigators and continues to be my close friend and colleague. This episode is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat and mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marsha O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but now is drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. You can buy Odessa from your favorite online retailer. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. If you were either informed, inspired, or entertained by stories today, don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our community. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, johnhoda.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.